Hello, I'm Louise Steinman, curator of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. You're about to hear Kevin Bales, president of Free the Slaves and author of Ending Slavery: How We Free Today's Slaves. Bales discusses what slavery is in the global economy, and he converses with Maria Suarez, an immigrant victim of sex trafficking. This program was originally produced on Wednesday, January 9th, 2008. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org.
It's great to be here. And I've got to say absolutely first that I grew up in a small town in Oklahoma, and if it hadn't been for our library, I would have gone insane. And that I just thank God for libraries every day, because they opened the world to me as a boy and probably got me to the point where I could stand here and talk about something that wasn't just about cows and wheat. So thanks a lot just for being a library, and thanks for being such a smart library. I want to tonight do a couple of things. We're going to do several things, in fact. But first, I want to talk about the nature and the reality of slavery today, just to give you a bit of an introduction. And then I want to talk to you about how we can bring slavery to an end. And then after that, Maria Suarez and I will be able to also have a bit of a conversation. We'll be able to chat and so forth. But let me just start off and talk about how is it, on earth could it be possible that we have so many people in slavery today. And I want to link that into some ideas. One of them is not this idea. And what I mean by that is that, you know, for thousands of years, philosophers, all the way back to the ancient Greeks and the ancient Romans, for the Essene Jewish philosophers, said, you know, slavery is all around us in our lives, but it's not a good thing. It really is something that shouldn't be here. It really should end. But it's always been with us, and it's a big industry, and it's part of our culture, so I guess there's not much we can do about it. But in fact, there's an anniversary. This year, in fact, just a few days ago, is the 200th anniversary of the ending of the slave trade in the United States. It was actually 1808, January 1st, that the legal end of the slave trade occurred in the United States. But I don't think that's the important anniversary. I think the important anniversary is actually the 221st anniversary of the day in 1787 when 12 people got together over a bookshop in London, England, and they sat around a table, and instead of saying, you know, slavery, I guess it really should end, but we can't do much about it, they said, we should end slavery. Now, the chutzpah of these 12 is mind-boggling. They were taking on an industry which modern historians say is the equivalent of the global automotive industry today. So these 12 sat around a table. They weren't rich. They weren't powerful. They weren't politicians. A bunch of them were Quakers and completely socially excluded at the time. And yet they sat there and said, why don't we bring a global industry to an end? Almost as if you could imagine all of us could like come up here and form a circle and say, okay, guys, let's bring the global automotive industry to an end. Shall we start now? And think about what would that actually mean in our lives to take that on. The mind-boggling fact was that, in fact, they did that and achieved it in terms of ending the slave trade in a mere 20 years. A mere 20 years. I want to come back to that. But I want to start off with that idea that when we look around at the size of slavery that I'm about to tell you about, it seems very daunting. It seems almost insurmountable. But in fact, if we look back to the people who've shown us the way, we see, yeah, it's a big problem, but it's a fixable problem. Now, there's slavery today. These are pictures just taken last year. Children, adults in this situation making bricks in Pakistan in a kind of bonded labor slavery, which is in fact hereditary. Here's another one of those. And the hands of one of those workers. I found these pictures so very compelling from one of our supporters who was there doing that work. And I want to be absolutely clear that when I talk about slavery today, I mean real slavery. This isn't about people with low-paid jobs. These aren't people who have really awful marriages or can't stop shopping or can't stop eating chocolate. I mean, this is about real, honest-to-God slavery in exactly the same way that people would recognize slavery throughout all human history. Because if you, in fact, look at slavery through history, and remember that the very first records of human history, the ones that occur about 5,000 to 6,000 years ago, those very first cuneiform marks on clay tablets at the beginning of what's called human civilization, those records include records of slavery. We know that, in fact, slavery existed before the first record, so it's in every bit of written human history. And if you unpack what the nature of that world of being a slave was about, you discover that in some places, sure, it was about race, about why people were enslaved. In other places, it was about tribe, and sometimes it was about religion. Sometimes it was about being the foreigner. But if you take away those different wrappings and you look at the core of that relationship between a master and a slave, what you discover is that the attributes are always the same, that there's a one person who's completely controlled by another, that violence is used to maintain that control, that the person isn't paid anything beyond a subsistence, you know, food and shelter, but nothing beyond that, and that they're putting money into the pockets of the person who have enslaved them, or today, putting money into the pockets of criminals, because that's, you know, today it's illegal in every country. But across all of human history, slavery has been about the complete control of one person by another, violence used to do it, money being made for the slaveholder, no payment beyond subsistence. And when we get out into the field and we see situations where slavery is occurring and we say, well, is that slavery? Is that slavery? We have to be sure about this. We ask our rule of thumb question, which is, can this person walk away? Because in some ways, that's the easiest, quickest way to do a quick check, is to say, if this person can walk away, even into a worse situation, then it's probably not slavery. Slavery is about that total physical control. Because, you know, one of the things that we as people who live in freedom have the privilege is to totally screw our lives up. You know, we can walk away from the situation we're in and do stupid things. But even that is denied to someone who's in slavery. They have no free will and can't walk away. Now, today, when there's a law against slavery in every country, it's important to understand how we could grow so much slavery. One of the things that we know is that slavery grows today when the law breaks down, when people cannot protect themselves. It can be civil war, it can be kleptocratic governments, it can be the negative impact of global economic changes, it can be environmental destruction, it can be the impact of an HIV/AIDS epidemic in your community. It could be all of those things sometimes, sadly, in some countries begin to happen all at the same time, and they push people into situations of vulnerability. They push people into situations where they're absolutely desperate. And in fact, something that's happened, which is kind of shocking and amazing, has to do with the linkage between the population explosion and the situation of slavery today. That enormous growth that we've had in the last 50 years of the population globally going from 2 billion people to over 6, you know, it's almost at 7 billion people now in the last 50 years. Most of that growth in the developing world, most of that growth in countries where exactly those kinds of vulnerabilities occur because of civil war and disease and environmental destruction and so forth. And in some ways, I think we all know that factoid, which is that about a billion people live on a dollar a day in the world today. That's sort of a you know, one of those things that everybody's heard. But what I want to point out to you is that that billion people represents the largest pool of potentially enslavable people that's ever existed in human history. Desperate, vulnerable, powerless people, something like a billion people in that situation. So many people in that powerless situation that there are now more slaves than at any time in human history. The number of people that we best estimate to be in slavery is 27 million at one time today. I'll point out that that number is twice the number of all the people who were removed from Africa in the entire 350 years of the transatlantic slave trade. So 13 million people are the best estimate of the historians that were removed from Africa in 350 years. Double that number are all in slavery around the world today. And I have to tell you, that's a conservative estimate. That's a conservative estimate based on a narrow definition that I gave you earlier, more narrow than many of the definitions put out even by the United Nations. What does that look like? Well, this young man's name is Drissa. We filmed him in the Ivory Coast. He had been an economic migrant in the sense that he was a very poor young man from the country of Mali. He was desperate for work. He was 19 years old. He heard that if he could go into the Ivory Coast, he could go to work in agriculture. He went into a market town looking for work with some buddies. And sure, they helped him find work. A man said, "I can get you a job," and sold him, literally sold him in the marketplace for, in his situation, about $30 to a farmer who bought Drissa and 16 other young men and took them into the countryside, brutalized them during the day, and had them working hard in agriculture, primarily in the cultivation and harvesting and processing of cocoa, which would then primarily be exported into the North American and Western European cocoa and chocolate markets and so forth. His situation helps us to sort of see how that works. Now, I appreciate that most of our minds are wrapped around that idea. This isn't just to taunt the young people who are in the audience who are looking for work after graduating. That's what this is. That most of us hold in our minds these ideas about historical slavery. And we tend to think about how slavery existed in the American South before the Civil War. And we tend to hold that picture in our minds and say, well, that's what slavery is about. It must be about physically capturing people, physically taking control of them, kidnapping them, and so forth. But interestingly, today, you don't have to do that. If you want to make a person into a slave today, a new slave, to mint new slaves today, you just have to ask this question. And I've been in countries around the world and remarkably have been told the same story in different languages by very different people, and the story goes something like this. We were living in this village and there was no work. And you know what? My kids were hungry. And in fact, my wife was sick and we couldn't afford medicine. And then this man came into the village with a pickup truck and he stood up in the back and he said, "Who wants to work? I've got jobs. Who needs a job?" And they pause and then they say, "And you know what? That guy looked like a crook. I didn't like the look of him. It looked dodgy to me. But my kids were hungry. And my wife was sick. And I thought, I got to go." And I put my hand up and I climbed to the back of that truck. And 50 miles later or 100 miles later, that part varies. And where they end up varies. But the reality doesn't vary. When they end up, where they end up is the fact that they begin to work. Somebody says, "Actually, you can't leave now. No, in fact, we're not going to be paying you this week." In fact, the slaveholders begin to tease them out, keeping them from knowing that the slavery has begun because they get more work out of them. And then finally, when the day comes, they say, "I can't stand this. This is not what you promised. I don't want this to go on like this. I'm going home. I don't care if you don't pay me." That's the day the gun comes out. That's the day that the blow hits the head. That's the day that the locks turn. And they find out, no, you don't leave. You work for us. And they discover that they're in slavery. It's a very common story. Now, of course, I have to tell you, most of the people in slavery around the world aren't necessarily new slaves. There are many people who are in hereditary slavery as well. Now, that leads me to one thing that's actually the only new thing I can tell you about slavery. It sounds strange to say that when we talk about modern slavery and old slavery and so forth, but in fact, there's only really one new thing about slavery, and that is that pool of 1 billion people who are potential slaves today have glutted the market for potential slaves. For almost all of human history, slaves have been high-ticket items in the labor market. Today, there are so many potential slaves that the price of slaves has absolutely collapsed. Now, I want to illustrate with that, this was something I just picked up off the television a couple of nights ago. Let's see if we can see this.
Major Ever live from the Trinity Court, thanks, mate. Okay, lovely discussion guarantees here as always as we get macro and talk commodities. Continuing here in the studio with our guest Michael O'Donoghue, head of commodities at Four Continents Capital Management. And we're also joined by Brent Lawson from Lawson Frisk Securities.
Happy to be here.
Good to have you, Brent. Now, gentlemen, Brent, where do you want to go in this year?
Well, Daphne, we've been going short on gas and oil recently and casting our net just a little bit wider. We really like the human being story a lot. If you look at a long-term chart, prices are at historical lows, and yet global demand for forced labor is still real strong. So that's a scenario that we think we should be capitalizing on.
Michael, what's your take on the people story? Are you interested?
Well, definitely. Non-voluntary labor's greatest advantage, as I said, is the endless supply. We're not about to run out of people. No other commodity has that.
Daphne, if I may draw your attention to one thing, that is that private equity has been sniffing around, and that tells me that this market is about to explode. Africans and Indians, as usual, South Americans, and Eastern Europeans in particular, are on our buy list.
Interesting. Michael, bottom line, what do you recommend?
We're recommending to our clients a buy and hold strategy. There's no need to play the market. There's a lot of valuable people out there. It's very exciting.
Gentlemen, thank you very much. Please stay with us. We'll be back after this short break with further insights into this fascinating market.
Okay, now before anyone leaps to their feet and says, that's outrageous, that is, of course, a parody. That's a little project that we've been doing with MTV that they've been showing on the European stations. But I just loved that piece in part because it shows us what we would actually be seeing if, in fact, slavery was still legal under the current situation. That's exactly the sorts of analysis that we'd be seeing because it describes what it's like in a world where people who are in slavery are, in fact, so very inexpensive. Here's the reality of the situation. A little chart of just the last 4,000 years of slave prices using a price index that we worked out, because I'm kind of a statistical nerdy guy with an economics background. So anyway, forgive me for this. It's my only chart. I won't make you look at it for very long. But as you can see, the left-hand scale is basically in tens of thousands of dollars. And for most of human history, the price of a slave was averaged in today's money about $40,000, until we reach a time in the late 50s, 60s when the population begins to shoot up. The population is the red dots, up over 2 billion, 3 billion, and the price completely collapses. Let me illustrate that to be perfectly clear with the reality of antebellum slavery. We know a lot about the prices of slaves in America before the Civil War. And the average slave, what was called a prime field hand, perhaps a 19-year-old agricultural worker, exactly like the young man that you saw earlier, Drissa, who had been so horribly whipped in the Ivory Coast. A 19-year-old prime field hand in 1860 or 1850 would cost between $1,000 and $1,200, $1,850 dollars. But $1,000 in 1850 is $40,000 in today's money. In 1850, you could buy a house for $1,000. You could buy a big piece of land. You could buy six or eight oxen, which is sort of like saying a tractor. It was fundamentally the equivalent of $40,000 a day. Drissa, that young man, was classic in the sense that he was a prime field hand of the 21st century, and he was sold in the market for about $30. And that's not unlike the prices that you find for human beings around the world today. The average is probably something like $100. And of course, that's led us into a new kind of situation where the price of human beings has collapsed. The one new thing about slavery is that they have gone from being capital purchase items that needed perhaps care over time because of the investment to being disposable, like styrofoam cups that you can crumple up and throw away. because they are simply disposable inputs to an economic process. It's altered the nature in some ways of slavery today. It means that people are not interested in long-term relationships with the people they enslave. It means that they're not concerned about having a deed of ownership. It means that their relationship to the people who are enslaved is much closer to that we have with the plastic pens in our pockets or the styrofoam cups that we own, as opposed to the relationship that we might have like with a car. And it's horrific because I'm actually describing inanimate objects and describing, in fact, relationships that we are also talking about with other human beings. Here's one of those disposable people. This little girl is one that we helped to rescue from slavery in the fishing industry around Lake Volta in Ghana. She's 5 years old, and her destitute parents were promised that she would be fed and educated if they were allowed to take her from her village, and she would learn the craft and the trade of working in fishing. It was a complete lie. She was taken to Lake Volta, where a lot of children are enslaved, and she was put to work. They work in the water. They work all night long. They untangle nets, which have underneath the water. They have to dive deeply. Sometimes they tie rocks to them to sink them down so that they can untangle the nets that have gotten caught in the wood under the water. Many of them drown. They clean fish. They sell fish. And, of course, they're also sexually abused by the people who have enslaved them. And if she had become ill or worse, she simply would have been dumped, usually just rolled off the side of the boat out in the middle of the lake, because the acquisition cost of this girl was something like $10 to $15, $20, somewhere in that range. The situation, I want to be really clear about this, that she came from was not about her parents selling her. Her parents were faced with the same choice that we find around the world today, which I always think of as the devil's choice. They lived in a village where food was very hard to come by and work was practically non-existent. They had children who were hungry. They had children who couldn't get education for. And then somebody came along and said, you know what? If you'd like to let your little girl come and work with us, that she can learn a trade, she'll be able to eat regularly, and there'll even be a chance that she can go to school. And they have to face that horrible choice. Would I let my children go? But if she stays with me, she may not live. I can't be certain of her safety, but if she stays here, she may starve. What a horrible choice. And sometimes some parents take the chance and say, I want to do anything I can that my child will have a decent life. And they give in, and they're being tricked, and they're being manipulated, and a little girl like this ends up in slavery. Luckily, we were able to find her about a year after she had been taken away, and we were able to reunite her with her family, and in fact, then work with her family to make sure that they were able to begin to build a life where they didn't ever have to face that temptation again, where they were able to build an economic autonomy to keep themselves free. I'll come back to that in a few minutes. You know, the lives that I've been talking about of slaves, it's really depressing. I appreciate that. I've told you things that could leave you depressed for days. And the ease at which those lives can be destroyed is heartbreaking. But I want to shift gears now, because I want to talk about the hope that's actually in this situation. And this cryptic little slide here about more being less is actually about the fact that we live in a moment in history when it's easier to get people out of slavery and it's easier to bring slavery to an end. And the reason why I say more is less is that I want to explain that, yes, 27 million people in slavery is more people in slavery than has ever existed. But it's also the smallest proportion of the global population to ever be in slavery. So while it's the largest raw number, it's the smallest fraction of the global population in slavery. Slaves around the world today generate, to the best of our calculation, about $32 billion worth of output into the global economy each year. Well, that in raw dollar terms is probably the largest amount in some ways that it may have ever been. But in terms of a fraction of the global economy, it is by far the smallest tiny fraction of the global economy to ever be generated by slave labor. So we have the smallest fraction of the world population in slavery, putting out the smallest fraction of the global economy from their labor. And it means that if we combine that with challenges that we don't have to face anymore, challenges like getting a law passed, because there's a law against slavery in every country, a challenge like having people who think it's okay. I mean, you know, if you went back 150 years, even in this country, there were ministers standing up in pulpits saying, actually, God says this slavery thing's okay, you don't have to worry about it. I mean, this doesn't happen anymore. And there are no gigantic economic interests propping up slavery today. There was a time when people would say, if we stop slavery, it would be a good thing, but unfortunately it would destroy the national economy, so we can't do it. That just doesn't happen today. It's just not possible. Yes, if we stop slavery tomorrow, there would be a number of individual criminal business people who would be discomforted, but I don't care, and I don't think you do either. That would be a good thing, and it would not in any way disrupt any business, any industry, or any economy anywhere in the world. And in fact, one of the things that we've learned is that if we disrupt slavery in any place, it increases the economic viability of that place. But I'll come back to that in a moment. Almost everyone agrees today that slavery is morally wrong. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights, innumerable laws, treaties, conventions, and so forth all say this has to come to an end. There's a law against it in every country. And the money is there to do the job if we put it in that direction. And you know, we live in a world where the challenges that we do face are not those major economic and political challenges of the past. They're actually very much conceptual challenges. The challenges we face today is that we need to have an awareness that slavery actually exists. This is one of our biggest ones, is the fact that so many people in the world think that when legal slavery ended, which is a little bit like saying when they passed the law against burglary, no one ever lost their television set again. But it didn't work that way. And it didn't work that way with slavery either. Slavery has been illegal in many countries for a very long time, and it's continued to exist in many countries, including our own, for a very long time. We also need commitment. We also need people to be able to say at our governmental level that they're going to carry through on their promises. Now, when I say carry through on their promises, what I mean is this. Let's use the United States as an example. This government, our government, has in the past made a promise to us, all of us, that there will not be slavery in this country. And they didn't just make a law. They put it into the fundamental organizing document of our country, into the Constitution. There will not be slavery in our country. Then they put it into the federal law. They put it in the state laws. It's absolutely clear. No slavery in America. That promise has been made and on the books for more than 100 years. And yet, where is the commitment to that promise? Where is the follow-through on that promise? And that's the same situation in many countries around the world, that we have that promise, but people are not keeping that promise. We need to carry through that commitment. And then we need the resources to carry that through. It costs something to bring people out of slavery around the world. Here's one of the important and interesting things that we discovered as we began to pick apart this knotty problem and say, what can we do? What does it cost? What could happen to bring people out of slavery? Well, we said there's all kinds of ways to do this. We can go from the bottom up. In other words, we can start where people are actually in slavery, and we do this around the world, and we can begin to help them out. Here, for example, is a raid where children who have been kidnapped and put into carpet looms for those beautiful handwoven rugs that you might have at home in northern India, people that we work with in northern India organize these raids with the police. They kick in the doors. This is a room with a loom. There's a man that you saw with sort of a red cap on. Here he is. He's looking for his son. We think we had found his son in this particular place. He'd been gone for almost 5 years. And indeed, it was his son. And we were able to reunite the father and son after some 5 years. That's fantastic. It's mind-blowing. It floods all of us with joy when we see that kind of liberation and reunification. But you know what? If we try to liberate 27 million people from slavery one at a time, it'll take centuries. It would just take too long. So we've also got to think about doing it from the top down as well as from the bottom up. The governments and international bodies, they have to make ending slavery a priority. And of course, as we've seen, they've already promised to do that. They've said they're going to do that in passing laws and the conventions and so forth. And at the moment, they're just not carrying through. In the United States, we spend in total about $200 million a year on slavery and human trafficking, which is almost enough to make a small dent in the problem. Just about enough to make a small dent in the problem. But in fact, the cost that we need to meet if we begin to truly want to solve this problem are not nearly as high as you might think. Oh, before I tell you about that cost, here's one of the top-down things. This is something new, and I just stuck this in because I was kind of excited about it. We've been chatting with the United Nations. Did you know the United Nations had a space program? I only knew that because I worked for the United Nations once, but they use satellite photos to look for refugees and environmental destruction and all kinds of things like that. But I was going through some of the satellite images and realized, hey, we can see slavery from space. Here's a charcoal camp in rural Brazil where slave labor is used to clear cut, slash the forests, all on the right side of the screen, where the forests are clear cut by enslaved labor, taken to those little bumps, which are in fact big kilns about this big, where the wood is burned down into charcoal, and then that charcoal made by slave labor is fed into the Brazilian steel industry to make rolled steel, which is one of their major exports to the United States, which is, in fact, if you were to reach under to your bottom, well, excuse me, but and touch the bottom of your seat, you'll find that you're sitting on rolled steel right now at the seat, the thing that holds your seat together, and could well be Brazilian steel. Slave labor, environmental destruction, spotted from outer space. Are the workers in that charcoal camp slaves? I don't know. But I tell you what, I do know. I know the exact GPS coordinates of that place. And we could go there and we could find out just like that. And the UN space program could be easily redirected into identifying those obvious indicators of enslavement from space. What does it really cost, though? Well, you know what? We've been very carefully analyzing the cost of liberation because we've been at it pretty intensely for about 5 years now in different parts of the world. Not buying people out of slavery. We don't do that. Buying people out of slavery is like paying a burglar to get your television back. That's not the way to go. The way to go is to help people to freedom and then also to help them to build new lives. But if you do that, what you discover is that there's a pretty significant range in the cost of bringing people to freedom. The lowest costs are in those places that you'd imagine where, in fact, you know, the economies are poor and the annual incomes are low. And we find that, for example, that family which was in hereditary debt bondage. In other words, granddad there was in fact a slave who inherited his situation of slavery from his parents. His son and his grandparent and his grandchildren there were all born into that same slavery. They all belong to the same master. We don't know how many generations that slavery goes back because the grandfather can only remember one generation before his, but of course he knows he was born a slave and that his father was born a slave. So it could go back 5 generations or 10 or 3. We just don't know. What we do know, and they were all enslaved in a quarry. They spent their lives from the time they were 3 or 4 years old making big rocks into little rocks and sometimes making sand, which I find mind-blowing. A product as ubiquitous as sand, the only way you could make it at a profit with hand tools would be to use slave labor. But they were enslaved in a quarry. The cost of the work that we did to bring them to an understanding of their rights, to help them to stand up for those rights, to stand up with them, lock arms with them against the slaveholders, to push that issue until the slaveholders backed off and we got governmental protections in there as well for those people. And especially, and this was the breakthrough for them, to get them a lease to open their own quarry. They don't really want to stay quarry workers, but they know how to run a quarry, and they said if we could run our own quarry, we'd have enough time to build up the income, to build new lives, and then we can begin to branch out. And the other thing is, they said, we want to earn money right away because the first thing we want to do is build a school for our kids. And they yanked their kids out of the workplace, and they put them in the school and so forth. Something like $130 for that family. The child in Ghana, rescued from Lake Volta, something like $400. Costs are higher in Ghana and so forth. If you come to the United States, it goes up into the $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 range because lawyers, medical care, higher costs for housing, you name it. But remember, most of the people in slavery are, in fact, in those countries where incomes are lowest and people are poorest. Most of the people in slavery around the world today actually live in South Asia, in India, Pakistan, Nepal, and those countries. And most of the people who need to come out of slavery would be coming out of slavery on the lower tickets. If you take the median and say, how much does it cost for people to come out of slavery? The answer is, at the median of about $400 per person, $10.8 billion. Now, that's more money than I've got, and probably even if we put all our money together, we wouldn't have $10.8 billion. But I am in Los Angeles, so it's possible we might, but I don't know. But I'll point out that 10.8 is what Americans spend on organic food in a year. And when I last gave this talk in Boston, I said, as you know, Bostonians, this is less, almost half what you just spent on the Big Dig project to dig tunnels under the Charles River, and they all groaned at once and so forth. Or in Seattle, this is what they've projected they're going to spend on their light rail system, which no one has ever even seen the light rail system. They spent something like half this already. $10.8 billion in the global economy is a drop in the bucket. And this isn't just per year. This is, in fact, over the entire period. Now, one other thing to say about this, and that is that wouldn't be money just lost, because when you bring people out of slavery, they begin to generate income. Slaves know how to work. They come out of slavery and they find liberation and they want to work for themselves and earn money for their kids and feed their kids and get their kids an education and get what they want to be what they've never had a chance to be, which sounds slightly strange to the American ear. They want to be consumers. They want to be able to buy food and clothes and housing and education and so forth. And interestingly, even if people who come out of slavery only make $2 a day, which is a terrible level of poverty, they would be generating $21 billion a year. There's a very substantial freedom dividend when people come out of slavery. And in fact, what we're measuring now is exactly what that freedom dividend's about. In another 2 or 3 years, we're going to be able to talk about precisely how that freedom dividend changes the nature of local and national economies as people come out of slavery. As we move forward, the one thing that we hold very strongly in our minds is this. When we begin to work on how to bring people, work best with people so that they could achieve freedom, we said we have to learn the lesson of the United States, because this is the country that did it the wrong way. In 1865, 4 million people were freed from slavery, and that was a great thing. But 4 million people were lifted out of slavery and then dumped into an economy without access to credit, education, political participation, and subjected to extreme prejudice and discrimination. And today, we are still paying the price for the botched emancipation of 1865. And we say, if people are going to come out of slavery today, we do not want to be here in 3 generations dealing with the horrific negative aftermath of a botched emancipation. So when we calculate and say $400, $130, $10,000, whatever it costs to bring someone out of slavery, we don't mean to the point of liberation. We mean to the point of liberation plus dignity, economic autonomy, citizenship, so that their lives are full lives and right lives. And that's how we figure the cost. In fact, the truth is that now, by using the work that we do and meeting with lots of other people who have been around the world working against slavery, we have the know-how. We know how to go into places. We know how to do it safely. We know how to do it effectively, cost-effectively, and how to achieve freedom that is stable and secure for people who are in slavery today. We know how to do that. It's not, there's no silver bullet. There's a whole box of different silver bullets. And in fact, my book is basically a box of silver bullets, all about, if this kind of situation, you need to do this, and that, you need to do that, and if you're an individual, you can do this, if you're a government, you can do that. But we know where those bullets are, and we know how to put them in the right box, and we know that those things work because we didn't include them until we had tested them and tried to make sure that, in fact, that's how slavery can end. I know this is a shocker. If you have assumed as a human being that slavery has been with us since the dawn of time, that it's almost like saying we can bring it into jealousy, we can bring it into hunger, we can, you know, but this one we can because we know how to do it. Now, it's also true if we only had a plan to do this, well, funnily enough, we've got this. All right, okay, that's cheeky, I'm sorry. This is what Alexis de Tocqueville said about those 12 men in the bookstore. He, in this book, was writing a little bit. You remember Democracy in America? It wasn't that book. It was another book of his. But he said, you know, in the section just before that, he said, you know, there's these people in history like Napoleon, like Julius Caesar, that we never forget. And yet, what did they do? They destroyed lives. They destroyed cultures. They caused the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people. They taught us the nature of disruption and dictatorship. But he said, we may not remember these 12, but he said, if you look across all human history, you will not find anything more extraordinary than 12 people without power changing the planet in a way that Caesar or Napoleon could never even dream of. He said it was just beyond his comprehension. Well, we actually stand at a moment in human history when our economies and our governments, our understanding and our moral beliefs, our hearts, they're all aligned into a constellation that means we can bring slavery to an end. If there's a basic truth I think that every person, every human being can agree on, it is that slavery should end. And I think we have to say, what good is all of this economic and political power, especially as Americans that we hold, what good is that power if we can't use it to end slavery? And I have to say, if we can't use that power that we have as citizens and members of the global economy, if we can't use that to end slavery, how can we say that we're free? Okay, thank you very much for listening to that bit. What I'd like to do now is I've been not dazzling you with science and charts and that sort of thing. What I'd like to do now is take it away from this sort of slightly more boring analytical side, and I want to introduce Maria Suarez. And I want to do that first, though, who's a person who is a survivor of slavery. And I want to introduce her, though, first by showing you a very short video clip about Maria, which will tell us something of her history. So if we may, we could see that bit of, here we go, thanks.
When I was a little girl, I saw my parents working hard. My dad, my mother, and my dream was to one day become somebody, have money, and give them the best of the life, treat them like king and queen.
Maria grew up on a farm in Mexico. In 1976, she came to the U.S. legally to live with her sister. Maria didn't speak English. Her 16th birthday was just a few weeks away. A woman Maria met on the street offered to find her work.
She told me not to tell my family that she was coming very soon. And to me, it sounded good because I said I'm going to surprise them with a job. but it was not a job. It was just a trick, a trap that I found.
The woman took the naive young girl to this house.
So when we got there, I met this man. He was an old man. Probably he was in his 65 or 70. House was like creepy. I didn't want to stay there. They keep telling me, you stay here, you meet my wife, because he had a wife. And then I take him to the house tomorrow. I didn't want it, but between them two, they convinced me.
Much later, police would report that the man was an old lecher who claimed to be a brujo or a witch, and that he had a history of buying young girls from Mexico and trading them in when they turned 20.
At the third day is when he told me that he had bought me, that I was his slave, that he paid $200 for me, that I was there to do whatever he wanted to do to me.
Maria says he told her he could read her mind and that he would kill her family if she tried to leave the house.
I was afraid of him. I was terrorized by him. He beat me, raped me. Every day he accused me mentally, physically, emotionally, spiritually, because I was not in touch with my family. I was not in touch with people because I was afraid of him.
Years went by. Dreams disappeared. Only fear remained.
The only thing I felt was fear. Fear all the time. So I figured that it has to stop me. I used to ask God, why did you forget about me? I'm your child.
Her family called the police several times. Officers investigated. They didn't do anything about a minor living with an older man.
I was so afraid that he was going to kill my family that I told the police that I was fine. I was okay.
5 years passed.
At the end, I was just living. Just living. Okay, one more day. As long as I can, that's it. If he's going to kill me, or I'm going to die. They died. They're human beings, and they need to find a way to send a message that they, what they're going
talk for just a few minutes, and then we'll open it up to questions, if that's okay. And let's just...
Okay.
Maria, I've been talking about figures and economy and the whole thing, and that's all fine. That's about the brain. But I want to ask you, what do we need to know in our hearts about this?
The main thing is for everybody to know that slave does exist, and we need to stop that one. Okay. We need to stop it and to keep on working on that, because it's not easy to live on that kind of life. It's not easy to live every day when you know that your family is in danger, you know your life is in danger, and you don't know if the next day you're going to wake up.
Now, this may sound like a silly question, but you know, it's one I get asked sometimes too, and I bet you do too. You were enslaved in America. This is a free country. Why didn't you just walk away? Why didn't you just run to a policeman? I mean, hey, it's a free country, right?
You're right. It's a free country, and it's very easy to say, but very hard to do it. Not only because I was afraid of the man who kept me in there, but I was afraid of losing my family, for him to kill my family. He had told me that the police was on his side. He even told me that that he was a witch and he can see whatever I was thinking. He can see my mind. He can see what I was doing and whoever I was talking to. So the fear is bigger than the desire for me to leave.
I don't know if you know that, in fact, the same tactics and mental manipulation are used on women from West Africa, in Western Europe and the United States, the same kind of magic.
Yes, I'm aware of that, and that's why I'm still working on that, and I'm going to keep on working till the last day of life, because it's an issue that I want to help others. I want for other people to be aware that this exists and to keep on working on it, because sometimes you feel so isolated, not only from the people, but mentally, that you don't know how to send the message to others. You don't know how to tell those people that, hey, I'm here, help me.
You know, when I defined slavery before, I talked about how basically slavery is an economic crime. Of course, it's a crime against humans, but it's used to make money. Slavery is about making money. How did this man use you to line his pockets?
This man, first of all, he bought me for $200, according to what he said. Then I started working in his house. He used me as a laborer, sexually, working in his yard. Every day, he never paid me a dollar. Then after that, after 18 years old, he sent me to work to a factory. I was working, and I was giving him all my whole check. The only thing I was getting back was change, just to use the phone to call him if I was going to work overtime.
Wow. Do you have any idea how much money you earned over that period?
I believe that I earned thousands with him. I don't know how much, but I believe a few thousands, yes.
So, but the theft of your labor, that's never been returned to you? There's never been any compensation for all that was stolen?
No, just my freedom today that I can feel free. And I can actually say that finally I'm starting to feel that justice started to show me that there is justice in there.
This is good. Is there any last thing that you want to make sure everyone here knows about what we can do?
Yes, I actually want to send a message to everybody not to be blind, not to think that it doesn't exist. There is a slavery, and here is a slavery everywhere, and people target the poor people, and it's an issue here and everywhere in the country, and it can be your neighbor, it can be your sister, it can be your mother, it can be your best friend in that situation, and that person don't know how to tell you, so you need to be more aware of how to see the symptoms on the person so you can help.
Great. Thank you, Maria. I think all of us have got this choice about whether or not we want to live in a world with slavery, you know, and we just have to look in our hearts and say, do I want to live in a world with slavery? You know, and if the answer is no, then we've just got to begin that process of learning what it's about and what are the signs of it around us and how do we make it stop in other countries as well.
Exactly. We need to work on not only in here but outside too.
Sure. That's, thank you so much. Thank you
You're
so
welcome.
Much for that. Let's.
Thank you.
We've run a tiny bit long, but that's okay. We've got some time for questions. So please, I would love to hear questions for Maria. If you've got one for me, that's okay. So you want to go to the microphone? Sure. So someone put their hand up just a moment ago, just down front. So.
Kevin and Maria, you both mentioned we have to open our eyes to see the signs and to see, recognize the signs so that we're not blind to slavery around us in the U.S. And I'd like to know what those are. And you mentioned some of the symptoms that you might not be able to recognize unless you really have your eyes open. I'd like to know what some of those symptoms are, too, so that I can walk around with my eyes open out here.
Sure.
Very good question. For example, you see a difference between an old man and a 16-year-old? You think that 16-year-old is going to be wanting to be with that 68-year-old? That's one of the things that we have to watch and see. Another thing, we see people who walk out at the same time every day doing labor in homes, places. You see houses close, everything is close, but it's people in there. So those are the symptoms, those are the things that we should be watching for. And it's a lot of other ones, I'm sorry.
Yeah, there's a few things like, you know, if you see someone who looks like, if you, for example, a classic situation in the United States is someone who's enslaved in domestic service. And it could be down the street and working as a maid. And it would be someone you saw regularly, but they very often might be school age. But in fact, they're there all the time. And you begin to realize not just that, but that person looks frightened. They look upset and worried. They've been told not to mix or talk to people, so they actually avoid contact. And if you do have a chance to talk to them and say, do you have your documents? Are you ever paid? You'll get the answer no. And often even just things like bruising can be one of the indicators. But let me point out that on our website, at freetheslaves.net, there you have a very clear set of those indicators, sort of a step-by-step. And there are several other places that we can point you to. Who else has a question? It's just here. Thank you.
You're very brave to come here and talk about this. I'm a little confused. You said that your family came to try and rescue you, and you said that you were afraid. The fear was the thing that prevented you from going with your family?
With the police?
I was a little confused about that.
Okay, first of all, thank you. Yes, I was afraid of going to my family because I knew if I go with my family, he was going to kill them. He had threatened me to kill my family and described in different ways how he was going to kill my family and burn their houses. So my fear was bigger than my own life. I care more for them than myself. Did that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay.
And that's very brave. And how did your family know where you were? How did they find you?
My family actually started reporting me with the police, and police didn't want to do anything. They said if I don't say anything, then I was okay. I was happy. Mm-hmm. So my family, they start just searching and searching, and finally my sister one day pretend that she was selling china and some of those expensive pots and pans, and she got to the house. Hmm. And when she got there, I just was shocked. But the old man wasn't there, and I just said, I called her by her name, and I hugged her, and then he knew it was my sister. He already knew. So that's the way how they found me.
Wow.
I'm sorry, I'm having a little bit sore throat.
Okay.
Well, thank you very much.
What's another question? So, well, just here then. People besides this section can ask questions. I just want you to know that, so it's okay.
The slide or the film said that Maria had a legal problem as of the spring of 2007. I think you originally said that she came over legally. So I want to know if everything has been settled now, if it's okay, and what the legal status is.
I'm still working on that. So far, I'm still under the T visa in this country. I'm working in different issues, which is the red, and it's also, it's another avenues where they're working, other people it's working. So I don't know yet where is my status, but for right now, I don't know what's going to happen to me between now and February.
Yeah. May I explain a little bit more? During the period of Maria's enslavement, the man who enslaved her was criminal in nature and involved her in activity. Things happened that led to her being arrested and convicted of a felony. And the situation is, of course, that if you're here legally, but you're convicted of a felony, once you have that's happened, you can then be deported. It's a very curious situation because she now also has the special visa, which allows victims of human trafficking, survivors of human trafficking, to stay in the country and ultimately get a green card. So it's a very curious limbo. The easiest way out of this would be a pardon from the governor or from the president.
Shall we write to him?
Yes, please. Yes, yeah.
Thank you.
As often as you like, yeah. That would be great. Yes, please. Just. Oh, yeah, sorry. Yes, please. Next one, please.
Thank you. Kevin, I wanted to ask you, the last slide is on constellations are aligned. And some of us have been watching this moment and a part of it for a number of years now. And I think I'm excited about seeing a tipping point where awareness is growing and movement is happening, and we're seeing a lot of growth in this area of addressing this issue globally. I'm wondering, in your opinion, who are the groups, what are the initiatives that you see as really coming together that are going to be the key players, that are going to make the difference, and how can we support them? And when you say that constellations are aligning, what does that mean? Who can we partner with, and what do you think is going to really make the difference to end it in our generation?
Well, you know, the group is actually American citizens. Yeah, but go up that way, because it's hard. Actually, the light's right in my eyes, and I couldn't see your, so I want to make sure we get up there. It's the individual citizens who are really the big group that are going to make something happen here. And I was very excited just a couple of weeks ago when we had the very first ever national opinion poll about attitudes and understanding of the issue of modern-day slavery. And I was gobsmacked. I was amazed to discover that, in fact, the level of comprehension on the part of the American public had reached the sort of 75-85% level. This was a big surprise to me. We were assuming that it was lower. And as usual, right, the politicians are running behind the people. That's not a big surprise. You know, that was the case with the civil rights movement. That was the case with the original abolitionist movement. People made the decision in their hearts and began to act, and then later the politicians caught up with them. So we haven't heard anything about this from the presidential candidates, because I don't think they understand that the majority of the American people are now aware of this issue and want to see something done about it. There's, of course, a lot of great groups to work with, both at the local, regional, and national level. Our organization, of course, works globally, and we tend to operate around the world with groups and within the United States as well. And, of course, we're very happy to have people join with us. But, you know, right here in Los Angeles is the Coalition Against Slavery and Trafficking, CAST, which has done great work with individuals who have been caught up in that situation and helped them to rehabilitation. And Maria was one of the beneficiaries of their legal department, for example, and helped a lot with that. The Polaris Project across the United States does fantastic work. And in fact, take you to our website, and you'll find links to other organizations in different places which are doing this great work, and who need all the help and support they can get. Now, what's a question back here?
Yes, hi. I'd like to thank you both for your work and for your courage. Thank you very, very much. Sure. I'd like to know if you have any idea how many slaves there are in this country, mm-hmm. What the demographics are, where those slaves are located, and what are the ethnicities, and is there, you know, any link?
Sure. Just a few years ago, we were commissioned by the United Nations to conduct the country assessment on the United States for their global analysis of forced labor and slavery and human trafficking. And we did this with the Human Rights Center at the University of California, Berkeley. The basic answer to your question, I have to first say, this is a hidden crime. It's a criminal activity, so the estimates are rough. Right, so don't count these as precise numbers. Given, for example, the work done by the CIA and the State Department and our own government, that's estimating that about 14,500 to 17,500 people are brought into this country each year to be new slaves, trafficked into this country each year to be new slaves, just if we're talking about the ones coming in from outside. From what we know about the length of time that people tend to be in slavery, the absolute minimum that we would estimate to be in slavery in America today would be somewhere around 48,000 to 50,000 people. That would be a very conservative estimate. In terms of the demographics, it's not all about sex trafficking in women. It's also about the enslavement of men in agricultural work, in sweatshop work, of men and women into restaurant and domestic service and so forth. We were able to, again, estimate that it looked like something under half of the people in slavery in the United States were enslaved into prostitution, that another 15 to 20% were in domestic service, another 10 to 15% were in agricultural work, and then there was a very large number of strange and weird types of enslavement around the United States. I know that sounds like an odd thing for me to say, but you know, I know of a case of a boys' choir enslaved from the country of Zambia and part of a charity scam where they were singing in churches but forced to do so. Cannoli factory in Long Island. Hair braiding shops with enslaved Cameroonian women. A troop of Chinese acrobats enslaved in Las Vegas. I mean, the list just goes on and on. If a criminal is clever and can see the hole where they can use a slave, and since slaves are tend to be invisible to the American population, they'll do it. They'll use it. What's another question? Great. Sure. Great.
Thank you both very much. This is a question for Maria, and also then a second question for Kevin. Maria, do you, with your personal experience, agree that slavery is primarily an economic crime? And then to Kevin, if I could also ask you, after Maria answers, why you're putting it in the framework of it being primarily an economic as crime as opposed to human rights or any other sort of framework.
Can you please repeat that question? I didn't understand exactly what you asked.
Kevin was saying earlier that slavery is primarily a crime about money, and I wanted to know if that is how you felt about it as well.
Absolutely right. That's they making the person work and work for nothing, so they putting money in their pockets, and the person is not getting any money. Is that answer? Yeah.
Well, and of course, I have to then argue with myself and say, I often, maybe I overspoke in the sense that I often try to emphasize the economic nature of slavery because we tend to think about slavery as this terrible, vicious, evil, physical assault on human dignity and lose sight of the fact that it's always been that plus economic exploitation. That fundamentally people enslave people to make money from them. No one's enslaved just to be mean. They do it because they want to make a profit. But it's those things linked together. If I tried to separate them, then I was overstating. Because obviously it's a vicious crime against human dignity. But it's one that's often linked or on the foundation of economic exploitation. So. Yes, thanks.
Hi. My question is, how do I, as a single person, make things better? And how can I make sure that I'm a responsible consumer, like the chocolate I buy is fair?
Sure. Do you want to say anything about that? Oh, okay. Let me start with you as a consumer. The truth of the matter is that it's very difficult for us to, at this moment, talk about exactly where the slavery is in the products you buy. That's the bad news. The other part of the bad news is that it's spread in so many of the products you buy. Your cell phones have a mineral in them called tantalum, which is mined with slave labor. There's slavery in cotton, sugar, coffee, cocoa, chocolate, timber, the steel that you're sitting on. The list goes on and on and on. But interestingly, the right approach to that is not just about boycotting. And the reason why is because in exactly the same way that the amount of slavery in the global economy is a tiny fraction, the amount of slavery in any particular commodity or product is also a very small fraction. And what we have to guard against is what would be the impact of an economic boycott. And let's take cocoa as an example. We think that in the Ivory Coast, something like 2% of the rural farmers who grow cocoa actually use slave labor. If we were to boycott Ivorian cocoa, it would collapse the national economy because that's their main cash crop. It would also mean that 98% of the farmers who don't use slaves would be pushed into bankruptcy and, in fact, toward a level of vulnerability that could lead to their own enslavement. So it's a very blunt way to deal with it. And in fact, we have to be much more surgical and strategic. And one of the ways that we do that is that we've worked for the last 5 years with the chocolate industry, in which they have voluntarily agreed to bankroll the efforts necessary to remove slavery from their product chain. They don't make a lot of noise about this because it's kind of embarrassing to say, hey, guess what? We don't have nearly as much slavery in our chocolate as we used to, right? So they don't want to go that way, but the truth of the matter is that they've shifted almost $15 million out of chocolate company profits into anti-slavery work that never would have been there before. And they've shown how to do that in a way that we are now trying to reach out to cell phone makers and guitar makers and blue jean makers to help them find a way to police their product chains as well. And we're going to be working that through in each way. Of course, there are alternatives. You can buy fair trade chocolate. You can buy fair trade coffee, fair trade sugar, and so forth. If you've got fair trade goods, you're almost guaranteed that there's no slavery in those goods. But what you can do as a person is, you know, I know what you'd like to do, right? You'd like to go over to India and like run in behind that policeman and kick that door in, right? Grab that slave child and throw him over your shoulder and run out, and then the sun would be setting and he would look at you in the eye, and you know, you'd have this beautiful moment of freedom and bonding with the slave child. And, you know, we all want to do that. But the truth is we can't do that because we don't speak the languages and we don't fit in, and we need to leave that to the experts who do that. And for those of us who live in the rich part of the world, it's about talking to your friends. It's about learning about the problem, because we can't solve a problem we don't understand by reading books and watching films and talking to people like Maria. But it's also about making sure that those people who do kick in the doors can have a salary to do it that goes on year after year. The truth of the matter is that those guys who kick in the doors, I'm embarrassed to tell you this, but we can't guarantee their salaries more than about 6 to 9 months ahead. Now that's crazy, because they put their lives on the line. Sometimes they get beaten up, and some of them have been killed, martyrs to freedom. And we can't even guarantee their salaries, because we can't guarantee the income to the anti-slavery movement necessary to pay their. Now, we have a rule in our organization that if we can't pay them, we don't take our salaries, they get theirs. But we need that stability of funding. And all the anti-slavery organizations need to reach that level where they have stability of funding to carry on that work overseas. So I'm being very blunt about it, but we've got something they need, and it's pocket change. And in many ways, the most important way to do that is not write some vast check. Okay, if you've got $1 billion, write us $1 billion. But if you don't, the thing that we need more than one donation now is we need 10 bucks a month from now until we get this problem wiped out. Something small that we can count on forever until the problem's solved. And that's how we'd make sure those guys get paid. And in fact, we can begin to clone them. Our big goal is to clone those liberators. Okay. Yeah, thank you all so, so much. Maria. Thank you.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arendt Fox. Additional support is provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, City National Bank, KPMG, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by David Ornette Cherry.